The spear point grazed the cheek of the lion's head he wore. Even then, the blow was so violent it almost tore the mask off. It would have gone right through my throat, the prince thought, dazed. Geras cursed as the locusts closed around him. Quentin heard the sound of running feet. Then the sellswords came rushing from the shadows. One of the guards glanced at them just long enough for Geras to get inside his spear. He drove the point of his sword onto the brass mask and up to the wearer's throat, even as the second locust sprouted a crossbow bolt from his chest. The last locust dropped his spear.
"Yield! I yield!"
"No! You die!" Keigo took the man's head off with one swipe of his arrow, the Valyrian steel shearing through flesh and bone and gristle, as if they were so much suet.
"Too much noise," he complained. "Any man with ears will have heard."
"Doug," Quentin said. The day's word was supposed to be Doug. "Why wouldn't they let us pass? We were told."
"You were told your scheme was madness. Have you forgotten?" said Pretty Maris. "Do what you came to do."
"The dragons," Prince Quentin thought. "Yes, we came for the dragons."
He felt as though he might be sick.
"What am I doing here? Father, why?"
"Four men dead in as many heartbeats, and for what?"
"Fire and blood," he whispered. "Blood and fire."
The blood was pooling at his feet, soaking into the brick floor. The fire was beyond those doors.
"The chains. We have no key."
Art said, "I have the key."
He swung his war hammer hard and fast. Sparks flew when the hammerhead struck the lock. And then again, again, again. On his fifth swing, the lock shattered, and the chains fell away in a rattling clatter so loud Quentin was certain half the pyramid must have heard them.
"Bring the cart."
The dragons would be more docile once fed. "Let them gorge themselves on charred mutton." Archibald Ironwood grasped the iron doors and pulled them apart. Their rusty hinges let out a pair of screams for all those who might have slept through the breaking of the lock. A wash of sudden heat assaulted them, heavy with the odours of ash, brimstone, and burnt meat. It was black beyond the doors, a sullen, Stygian darkness that seemed alive and threatening, hungry. Quentin could sense that there was something in that darkness, coiled and waiting. "Warrior, grant me courage," he prayed. He did not want to do this, but he saw no other way.
"Why else would Daenerys have shown me the dragons? She wants me to prove myself to her."
Geras handed him a torch. He stepped through the doors.
"The green one is Rhaegal, the white Viserion," he reminded himself. "Use their names. Command them. Speak to them calmly but sternly. Master them, as Daenerys mastered Drogon in the pit."
The girl had been alone, clad in wisps of silk, but fearless.
"I must not be afraid. She did it. So can I."
The main thing was to show no fear.
"Animals can smell fear, and dragons."
What did he know of dragons?
What does any man know of dragons? They have been gone from the world for more than a century.
The lip of the pit was just ahead. Quentin edged forward slowly, moving the torch from side to side. Walls and floor and ceiling drank the light.
Scorched, he realized. Bricks burnt black, crumbling into ash.
The air grew warmer with every step he took. He began to sweat. Two eyes rose up before him. Bronze they were, brighter than polished shields, glowing with their own heat, burning behind a veil of smoke rising from the dragon's nostrils. The light of Quentin's torch washed over scales of dark green, the green of moss in the deep woods at dusk, just before the last light fades. Then the dragon opened its mouth, and light and heat washed over them. Behind a fence of sharp black teeth, he glimpsed the furnace glow, the shimmer of a sleeping fire 100 times brighter than his torch. The dragon's head was larger than a horse's, and the neck stretched on and on, uncoiling like some great green serpent. as the head rose until those two glowing bronze eyes were staring down at him.
Green, the prince thought. His scales are green.
Rachel,
he said, his voice caught in his throat, and what came out was a broken croak.
Frog, he thought. I'm turning into frog again.
The food, he croaked, remembering. Bring the food. The big man heard him. Arch wrestled one of the sheep off the wagon by two legs, then spun and flung it into the pit. Rhaegal took it in the air. His head snapped round, and from between his jaws a lance of flame erupted. A swirling storm of orange and yellow fire shot through with veins of green. The sheep was burning before it began to fall. Before the smoking carcass could strike the bricks, the dragon's teeth closed round it. A nimbus of flames still flickered about the body. The air stank of burning wool and brimstone. Dragon stink.
I thought there were two, the big man said.
Viserion, yes. Where is Viserion?
The prince lowered his torch to throw some light into the gloom below. He could see the green dragon ripping at the smoking carcass of the sheep, his long tail lashing from side to side as he ate. A thick iron collar was visible about his neck, with 3 feet of broken chain dangling from it. Shattered links were strewn across the floor of the pit amongst the blackened bones, twists of metal, partly melted.
Rhaegal was chained to the wall and floor the last time I was here, the prince recalled, but Viserion hung from the ceiling.
Quentin stepped back, lifted the torch, craned his head back. For a moment he saw only the blackened arches of the bricks above, scorched by dragon flame. A trickle of ash caught his eye, betraying movement.
Something pale, half-hidden, stirring. He's made himself a cave, the prince realized. A burrow in the brick.
The foundations of the Great Pyramid of Meereen were massive and thick to support the weight of the huge structure overhead. Even the interior walls were 3 times thicker than any castle's curtain walls. But Viserion had dug himself a hole in them with flame and claw, a hole big enough to sleep in.
And we've just woken him.
He could see what looked like some huge white serpent uncoiling inside the wall. Upward it curved to become the ceiling. More ash went drifting downward, and a bit of crumbling brick fell away. The serpent resolved itself into a neck and tail, and then the dragon's long horned head appeared, his eyes glowing in the dark like golden coals. His wings rattled, stretching. All of Quentin's plans had fled his head. He could hear Kago Korpskiller shouting to his sellswords.
The chains! He is sending for the chains, the Dornish prince thought.
The plan had been to feed the beasts and chain them in their torpor, just as the queen had done. One dragon, or preferably both.
More meat, Quentin said.
Once the beasts were fed, they will become sluggish. He had seen it work with snakes in Dawn, but here, with these monsters,
bring, bring!
Viserion launched himself from the ceiling, pale leather wings unfolding, spreading wide. The broken chain dangling from his neck swung wildly. His flame lit the pit. Pale gold shot through with red and orange, and the stale air exploded in a cloud of hot ash and sulphur as the white wings beat and beat again. A hand seized Quentin by the shoulder. The torch spun from his grip to bounce across the floor, then tumbled into the pit, still burning. He found himself face to face with a brass ape.
Geras.
Quent, this will not work.
That you're wild.
The dragon came down between the Dornish men and the door with a roar that would have sent 100 lions running. His head moved side to side as he inspected the intruders. Dornishmen, windblown, Kago. Last and longest, the beast stared at Pretty Maris, sniffing.
The woman, Quentin realized. He knows that she is female. He's looking for Daenerys. He wants his mother and does not understand why she's not here.
Quentin wrenched free of Garrus's grip, Viserion, he called. The white one is Viserion. For half a heartbeat, he was afraid he'd gotten it wrong. Viserion, he called again, fumbling for the whip hanging from his belt. She cowed the black one with a whip. I need to do the same. The dragon knew his name. His head turned, and his gaze lingered on the Dornish prince for three long heartbeats. Pale fires burned behind the shining black daggers of his teeth. His eyes were lakes of molten gold, and smoke rose from his nostrils. "Down," Quentin said. Then he coughed, and coughed again. The air was thick with smoke, and the sulphur stench was choking. Viserion lost interest. The dragon turned back toward the windblown and lurched toward the door. Perhaps he could smell the blood of the dead guards, or the meat in the butcher's wagon, or perhaps he had only now seen that the way was open. Quentin heard the cell sword shouting. Kago was calling for the chains, and Pretty Maris was screaming at someone to step aside. The dragon moved awkwardly on the ground, like a man scrabbling on his knees and elbows, but quicker than the Dornish prince would have believed. When the wind blown were too late to get out of his way, Viserion let loose with another roar. Quentin heard the rattle of chains, the deep thrum of a crossbow. "No!" he screamed. "No, don't! Don't!" But it was too late. "The fool!" was all that he had time to think as the quarrel caromed off Viserion's neck to vanish in the gloom. A line of fire gleamed in its wake. Dragon's blood, glowing gold and red. The crossbowman was fumbling for another quarrel as the dragon's teeth closed round his neck. The man wore the mask of a brazen beast, the fearsome likeness of a tiger. As he dropped his weapon to try and pry apart Viserion's jaws, flame gouted from the tiger's mouth. The man's eyes burst with soft popping sounds, and the brass around them began to run. The dragon tore off a hunk of flesh, most of the sellsword's neck, then gulped it down as the burning corpse collapsed to the floor. The other windblown were pulling back. This was more than even Pretty Maris had the stomach for. The Viserion's horned head moved back and forth between them and his prey, but after a moment he forgot the sellswords and bent his neck to tear another mouthful from the dead man, a lower leg this time. Quentin let his whip uncoil. "Viserion!" he called, louder this time. He could do this. He would do this. His father had sent him to the far ends of the earth for this. He would not fail him. "Viserion!" He snapped the whip in the air with a crack that echoed off the blackened walls. The pale head rose. The great gold eyes narrowed. Wisps of smoke spiraled upward from the dragon's nostrils. "Down!" the prince commanded. "You must not let him smell your fear. Down, down, down!" He brought the whip around and laid a lash across the dragon's face. Viserion hissed. And then a hot wind buffeted him, and he heard the sound of leathern wings, and the air was full of ash and cinders, and a monstrous roar went echoing off the scorched and blackened bricks, and he could hear his friends shouting wildly. Garrus was calling out his name over and over, and the big man was bellowing, "Behind you! Behind you! Behind you!" Quentin turned and threw his left arm across his face to shield his eyes from the furnace wind. "Regal," he reminded himself. "The green one is Regal." When he raised his whip, he saw that the lash was burning, his hand as well. All of him. All of him was burning. "Oh," he thought. Then he began to scream. Bran. The ashes fell like a soft gray snow. He padded over dry needles and brown leaves to the edge of the wood, where the pines grew thin. Beyond the open fields, he could see the great piles of man-rock stark against the swirling flames. The wind blew hot and rich, with a smell of blood and burnt meat, so strong he began to slaver. Yet as one smell drew them onward, others warned them back. He sniffed at the drifting smoke. Men, Many men, many horses, and fire, fire, fire. No smell was more dangerous, not even the hard, cold smell of iron, the stuff of man-claws and hard-skin. The smoke and ash clouded his eyes, and in the sky he saw a great winged snake whose roar was a river of flame. He bared his teeth, but then the snake was gone. Behind the cliffs, tall fires were eating up the stars. All through the night the fires crackled, and once there was a great roar and a crash that made the earth jump under his feet. Dogs barked and whined, and horses screamed in terror. Howls shuddered through the night, the howls of the man-pack, wails of fear and wild shouts, laughter and screams. No beast was as noisy as man. He pricked up his ears and listened, and his brother growled at every sound. They prowled under the trees as a piny wind blew ashes and embers through the sky. In time, the flames began to dwindle, and then they were gone. The sun rose grey and smoky that morning. Only then did he leave the trees, stalking slow across the fields. His brother ran with him, drawn to the smell of blood and death. They padded silent through the dens that men had built of wood and grass and mud. Many and more were burned, and many and more were collapsed. Others stood as they had before. Yet nowhere did they see or scent a living man. Crows blanketed the bodies and leapt into the air screeching when his brother and he came near. The wild dogs slunk away before them. Beneath the great grey cliffs, a horse was dying noisily, struggling to rise on a broken leg and screaming when he fell. His brother circled round him, then tore out his throat while the horse kicked feebly and rolled his eyes. When he approached the carcass, his brother snapped at him and laid back his ears, and he cuffed him with a forepaw and bit his leg. They fought amidst the grass and dirt and falling ashes beside the dead horse, until his brother rolled on his back in submission, tail tucked low. One more bite at his upturned throat, then he fed and let his brother feed and licked the blood off his black fur. The dark place was pulling at him by then. The house of whispers, where all men were blind. He could feel its cold fingers on him. The stony smell of it was a whisper up the nose. He struggled against the pull. He did not like the darkness. He was wolf. He was hunter and stalker and slayer, and he belonged with his brothers and sisters in the deep woods, running free beneath the starry sky. He sat on his haunches, raised his head, and howled. "I will not go," he cried. "I am wolf. I will not go." Yet even so, the darkness thickened, until it covered his eyes and filled his nose and stopped his ears, so he could not see or smell or hear or run. And the grey cliffs were gone, and the dead horse was gone, and his brother was gone, and all was black and still and black and cold and black and dead and black.
"Bran," a voice whispered softly. "Bran, come back. Come back now, Bran. Bran."
He closed his third eye and opened the other two, the old two, the blind two. In the dark place, all men were blind, but someone was holding him. He could feel arms around him, the warmth of a body snuggled close. He could hear Hodor singing, "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor," quietly to himself. "Bran," it was Mira's voice.
"You are thrashing, making terrible noises. What did you see?"
"Winterfell." His tongue felt strange and thick in his mouth. "One day, when I come back, I won't know how to talk any more." It was Winterfell. It was all on fire. There were horse smells and steel and blood. They killed everyone, Mira.
He felt her hand on his face, stroking back his hair. "You're all sweaty," she said. "Do you need a drink?"
"A drink," he agreed. She held a skin to his lips, and Bran swallowed so fast the water ran out of the corner of his mouth. He was always weak and thirsty when he came back, and hungry too. He remembered the dying horse, the taste of blood in his mouth, the smell of burnt flesh in the morning air.
"How long?" 3 days, said Jojen.
The boy had come up softfoot, or perhaps he'd been there all along, in this blind black world. Bran could not have said.
"We were afraid for you."
"I was with Summer," Bran said.
"Too long. You'll starve yourself. Mira dribbled a little water down your throat, and we smeared honey on your mouth, but it is not enough."
"I ate," said Bran. "We ran down an elk and had to drive off a tree cat that tried to steal him." The cat had been tan and brown, only half the size of the direwolf's, but fierce. He remembered the musky smell of him and the way he had snarled down at them from the limb of the oak.
"The wolf ate," Jojen said, "not you. Take care, Bran. Remember who you are."
He remembered who he was all too well. Bran the boy. Bran the broken. Better Bran the beastling. Was it any wonder he would sooner dream his summer dreams, his wolf dreams? Here, in the chill, damp darkness of the tomb, his third eye had finally opened. He could reach Summer whenever he wanted, and once he had even touched Ghost and talked to John. Though maybe he had only dreamed that. He could not understand why Jojen was always trying to pull him back now. Bran used the strength of his arms to squirm to a sitting position. "I have to tell Usha what I saw. Is she here? Where did she go?" The wildling woman herself gave answer.
"Nowhere, my lord. I've had my fill of blundering in the black."
He heard the scrape of a heel on stone, turned his head toward the sound, but saw nothing.
He thought he could smell her, but he wasn't sure. All of them stank alike,
and he did not have Summer's nose to tell one from the other.
"Last night I pissed on a king's foot," Usher went on. "Might be it was morning, who can say? I was sleeping, but now I'm not."
They all slept a lot, not only Bran. There was nothing else to do. Sleep and eat and sleep again, and sometimes talk a little, but not too much, and only in whispers, just to be safe. Usher might have liked it better if they had never talked at all, but there was no way to quiet Rickon or to stop Hodor from muttering, "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor," endlessly to himself. "Usher," Bran said, "I saw Winterfell burning." Off to his left, he could hear the soft sound of Rickon's breathing.
"A dream," said Usher.
"A wolf dream," said Bran. "I smelled it too. Nothing smells like fire or blood."
"Whose blood?"
"Men, horses, dogs, everyone. We have to go see."
"This scrawny skin of mine's the only one I got," said Usher. "That squid prince catches hold of me. They'll strip it off my back with a whip."
Mira's hand found Bran's in the dark and gave his fingers a squeeze.
"I'll go if you're afraid."
Bran heard fingers fumbling at leather, followed by the sound of steel on flint. Then again. A spark flew, caught. Usher blew softly. A long, pale flame awoke, stretching upward like a girl on her toes. Usher's face floated above it. She touched the flame with the head of a torch. Bran had to squint as the pitch began to burn, filling the world with orange glare. The light woke Rickon, who sat up yawning. When the shadows moved, it looked for an instant as if the dead were rising as well. Lyanna and Brandon, Lord Rickard Stark, their father, Lord Edwile, his father, Lord Willem and his brother Artus the Implacable, Lord Donor and Lord Beren and Lord Rodwell, One-Eyed Lord Jonhall, Lord Bath and Lord Brandon, and Lord Cregan, who had fought the Dragon Knight. On their stone chairs they sat, with stone wolves at their feet. This was where they came, when the warmth had seeped out of their bodies. This was the dark hall of the dead, where the living feared to tread. And in the mouth of the empty tomb that waited for Lord Eddard Stark, beneath his stately granite likeness, the six fugitives huddled around their little cache of bread and water and dried meat.
"Little enough left,"
Usher muttered as she blinked down on their stores.
"I'll need to go up soon to steal food in any case, or we'll be down to Eton Hodor."
"Hodor," Hodor said, grinning at her.
"Is it day or night up there?" Usher wondered. "I've lost all count of such."
"Day," Bran told her, "but it's dark from all the smoke."
"My lord is certain."
Never moving his broken body, he reached out all the same, and for an instant he was seeing double. There stood Usher, holding the torch, and Mira, and Jojen, and Hodor, and the double row of tall granite pillars, and long-dead lords behind them, stretching away into darkness. But there was Winterfell as well, grey with drifting smoke, the massive oaken iron gates charred and askew, the drawbridge down in a tangle of broken chains and missing planks. Bodies floated in the moat, islands for the crows. "Certain," he declared. Usher chewed on that a moment.
"I'll risk a look, then. I want the lot of you close behind. Mira, get Bran's basket." "Are we going home?"
Rickon asked excitedly.
"I want my horse. I want apple cakes and butter and honey and Shaggy. Are we going where Shaggy Dog is?"
"Yes," Bran promised, "but you'll have to be quiet." Mira strapped the wicker basket to Hodor's back and helped lift Bran into it, easing his useless legs through the holes. He had a queer flutter in his belly. He knew what awaited them above, but that did not make it any less fearful. As they set off, he turned to give his father one last look, and it seemed to Bran that there was a sadness in Lord Eddard's eyes, as if he did not want them to go.
"We have to," he thought. "It's time."
Usher carried her long oaken spear in one hand and the torch in the other. A naked sword hung down her back, one of the last to bear Mickon's mark. He had forged it for Lord Eddard's tomb to keep his ghosts at rest. But with Mickon slain and the ironmen guarding the armory, good steel had been hard to resist, even if it meant grave robbing. Mira had claimed Lord Rickard's blade, though she complained that it was too heavy. Brandon took his namesakes, the sword made for the uncle he had never known. He knew he would not be much use in a fight, but even so the blade felt good in his hand. But it was only a game, and Bran knew it. Their footsteps echoed through the cavernous crypts. The shadows behind them swallowed his father, as the shadows ahead retreated to unveil other statues. No mere lords, these, but the old kings in the north. On their brows they wore stone crowns. Torrhen Stark, the king who knelt. Edwin the Spring King. Theon Stark, the hungry wolf. Brandon the Burner and Brandon the Shipwright. Jorah and Jonas. Brandon the Bad. Walton the Moon King. Edirion the Bridegroom. Iron, Benjen the Sweet and Benjen the Bitter, King Edric Snowbeard. Their faces were stern and strong, and some of them had done terrible things, but they were Starks, every one, and Bran knew all their tales. He had never feared the Crypts. They were part of his home, and who he was, and he had always known that one day he would lie here too. But now he was not so certain. "If I go up, will I ever come back down? Where will I go when I die?" Wait, Usher said, when they reached the twisting stone stairs that led up to the surface, and down to the deeper levels, where kings more ancient still sat their dark thrones. She handed Mira the torch. I'll grope my way up. For a time, they could hear the sound of her footfalls, but they grew softer and softer until they faded away entirely.
Hodor,
said Hodor nervously. Bran had told himself 100 times how much he hated hiding down here in the dark, how much he wanted to see the sun again, to ride his horse through wind and rain. But now that the moment was upon him, he was afraid. He felt safe in the darkness. When you could not even find your own hand in front of your face, it was easy to believe that no enemies could ever find you either. And the Stone Lords had given him courage. Even when he could not see them, he had known they were there. It seemed a long while before they heard anything again. Bran had begun to fear that something had happened to Usher. His brother was squirming restlessly.
I want to go home, he said loudly.
Hodor bobbed his head and said,
Hodor!
Then they heard the footsteps again, growing louder, and after a few minutes, Usher emerged into the light, looking grim.
Something is blocking the door. I can't move it.
Hodor can move anything, said Bran. Usher gave the huge stable boy an appraising look.
Might be he can. Come on, then.
The steps were narrow, so they had to climb in single file. Usher led. Behind came Hodor, with Bran crouched low on his back so his head wouldn't hit the ceiling. Mira followed with a torch, and Jojen brought up the rear, leading Rickon by the hand. Around and around they went, and up, Bran thought he could smell smoke now, but perhaps that was only the torch. The door to the crypts was made of ironwood. It was old and heavy, and lay at a slant to the ground. Only one person could approach it at a time. Usher tried once more when she reached it, but Bran could see that it was not budging. Let Hodor try. They had to pull Bran from his basket first, so he would not get squished. Mira squatted beside him on the steps, one arm thrown protectively across his shoulders, as Usher and Hodor traded places. Open the door, Hodor, Bran said. The huge stable boy put both hands flat on the door, pushed and grunted. Hodor! He slammed a fist against the wood, and it did not so much as jump. Hodor! Use your back, urged Bran, and your legs. Turning, Hodor put his back to the wood and shoved. Again, again. Hodor! He put one foot on a higher step, so he was bent under the slant of the door and tried to rise. This time the wood groaned and creaked. Hodor! The other foot came up a step, and Hodor spread his legs apart, braced and straightened. His face turned red, and Bran could see cords in his neck bulging as he strained against the weight above him. Hodor! 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 From above came a dull rumble. Then suddenly the door jerked upward, and a shaft of daylight fell across Bran's face, blinding him for a moment. Another shove brought the sound of shifting stone, and then the way was open. Usher poked her spear through and slid out after it, and Rickon squirmed through Mira's legs to follow. Hodor shoved the door open all the way and stepped to the surface. The reeds had to carry Bran up the last few steps. The sky was a pale grey, and smoke eddied all around them. They stood in the shadow of the first keep, or what remained of it. One whole side of the building had torn loose and fallen away. Stones and shattered gargoyles laid strewn across the yard. They fell just where I did, Bran thought when he saw them. Some of the gargoyles had broken into so many pieces it made him wonder how he was still alive at all. Nearby, some crows were pecking at a body crushed beneath the tumble stone. But he lay face down, and Bran could not say who he was. The first keep had not been used for many hundreds of years, but now it was more of a shell than ever. The floors had burned inside it, and all the beams. Where the wall had fallen away, they could see right into the rooms, even into the privy. Yet behind, the broken tower still stood, no more burned than before. Jojen Reed was coughing from the smoke.
"Take me home," Rickon demanded. "I want to be home."
Hodor stumped in a circle.
"Hodor,"
he whimpered in a small voice. They stood huddled together with ruin and death all around them.
"We made noise enough to wake a dragon," Osha said, "but there's no one come. The castle's dead and burned, just as Bran dreamed. But we had best—"
She broke off suddenly at a noise behind them, and whirled with her spear at the ready. Two lean, dark shapes emerged from behind the broken tower, padding slowly through the rubble. Rickon gave a happy shout of, "Shaggy!" and the black direwolf came bounding toward him. Summer advanced more slowly, rubbed his head against Bran's arm, and licked his face.
"We should go," said Jojen. "So much death will bring other wolves besides Summer and Shaggy Dog, and not all on 4 feet." "Eh, soon enough," Usher agreed. "But we need food, and there may be some survive this. Stay together. Mira, keep your shield up and guard our backs."
It took the rest of the morning to make a slow circuit of the castle. The great granite walls remained, blackened here and there by fire, but otherwise untouched. But within, all was death and destruction. The doors of the great hall were charred and smouldering, and inside the rafters had given way and the whole roof had crashed down onto the floor. The green and yellow panes of the glass gardens were all in shards, the trees and fruits and flowers torn up or left exposed to die. Of the stables, made of wood and thatch, nothing remained but ashes, embers, and dead horses. Bran thought of his dancer and wanted to weep. There was a shallow, steaming lake beneath the library tower, and hot water gushing from a crack inside. The bridge between the bell tower and the rookery had collapsed into the yard below, and Maester Luan's turret was gone. They saw a dull red glow shining up through the narrow cellar windows beneath the great keep, and a second fire still burning in one of the storehouses. Usher called softly through the blowing smoke as they went, but no one answered. They saw one dog, worrying at a corpse, but he ran when he caught the scent of the direwolves. The rest had been slain in the kennels. The maester's ravens were paying court to some of the corpses, while the crows from the broken tower attended others. Bran recognized Poxy Tim, even though someone had taken an axe to his face. One charred corpse outside the ashen shell of Mother Sept sat with his arms drawn up and his hands balled into hard black fists, as if to punch anyone who dared approach him.
"If the gods are good," Usher said in a low, angry voice, "the others will take them that did this work."
"It was Theon," Bran said blackly.
"No, look."
She pointed across the yard with her spear.
"That's one of his iron men. And there. And there's Greyjoy's warhorse, see? The black one with the arrows in him."
She moved among the dead, frowning.
"And here's Black Loren."
He had been hacked and cut so badly that his beard looked a reddish brown now.
"Took a few with him, he did."
Usher turned over one of the other corpses with her foot.
"There's a badge. A little man. All red."
"The flayed man of the Dreadfort," said Bran. Summer howled and darted away.
"The guards would."
Mira Reed ran after the direwolf, her shield and frog spear to hand. The rest of them trailed after, treading their way through smoke and fallen stones. The air was sweeter under the trees. A few pines along the edge of the wood had been scorched, but deeper in the damp soil and green wood had defeated the flames. "There is a power in living wood," said Jojen Reed, almost as if he knew what Bran was thinking. "A power strong as fire." On the edge of the black pool, beneath the shelter of the heart tree, Maester Luin lay on his belly in the dirt. A trail of blood twisted back through damp leaves where he had crawled. Summer stood over him, and Bran thought he was dead at first. But when Mira touched his throat, the maester moaned.
"Hodor," said Hodor mournfully. "Hodor."
Gently, they eased Luin onto his back. He had grey eyes and grey hair, and once his robes had been grey as well, but they were darker now, where the blood had soaked through.
"Bran,"
he said softly, when he saw him sitting tall on Hodor's back.
"And Rickon, too."
He smiled.
"The gods are good. I knew."
"Knew?" said Bran uncertainly.
"The legs. I could tell. The clothes fit. But the muscles in his legs. Poor lad."
He coughed, and blood came up from inside him.
"You vanished in the woods. How, though?"
"We never went," said Bran. "Well, only to the edge, and then doubled back. I sent the wolves on to make a trail, but we hid in father's tomb."
"The crypts," Luin chuckled, a froth of blood on his lips. When the maester tried to move, he gave a sharp gasp of pain.
Tears filled Bran's eyes. When a man was hurt, you took him to the maester. But what could you do when your maester was hurt?
"We'll need to make a litter to carry him," said Usher.
"No use," said Luin. "I'm dying, woman."
"You can't," said Rickon angrily. "No, you can't."
Beside him, Shaggy Dog bared his teeth and growled. The maester smiled.
"Hush now, child. I'm much older than you. I can die as I please."
"Hodor, down," said Bran. Hodor went to his knees beside the maester.
"Listen," Luin said to Usher. "The princes, Rob's heirs, not together. Do you hear?"
The wildling woman leaned on her spear.
"Aye, safer apart. But where to take them? I thought might be these servants."
Maester Luin shook his head, though it was plain to see what the effort cost him.
"Serwin boy's dead. Sir Roderick, Leobald Tallheart, Lady Hornwood, all slain. Deepwood fallen. Moat Caelan. Soon Torren Square. Iron Men on the stony shore. And east, the Bastard of Bolton."
"Then where?"
asked Usher.
"White Harbour. The Umbers. I do not know. War everywhere. Each man against his neighbour. And winter's coming. Such folly. Such black, mad folly."
Maester Luin reached up and grasped Bran's forearm, his fingers closing with a desperate strength.
"You must be strong now. Strong."
"I will be," Bran said, though it was hard. "So Roderick killed? And Maester Luin?"
"Everyone. Everyone."
"Good,"
the maester said.
"Good boy. Your father's son, Bran. Now, go."
Usher gazed up at the weirwood, at the red face carved in the pale trunk.
"And leave you for the gods?"
"I beg," the maester swallowed. A drink of water and another boon, if you would."
"Aye," she turned to Mira, "take the boys."
Jojen and Mira led Rickon out between them. Hodor followed. Low branches whipped at Bran's face as they pushed between the trees, and the leaves brushed away his tears. Usher joined them in the yard a few moments later. She said no word of Maester Lewin. Hodor must stay with Bran to be his legs, the wildling woman said briskly. I will take Rickon with me. We'll go with Bran, said Jojen Reed.
I thought you might, said Usher. Believe I'll try the East Gate and follow the King's Road a ways. We'll take the Hunter's Gate, said Mira.
Hodor, said Hodor.
They stopped at the kitchens first. Usher found some loaves of burnt bread that were still edible, and even a cold roast fowl that she ripped in half. Mira unearthed a crock of honey and a big sack of apples. Outside they made their farewells. Rickon sobbed and clung to Hodor's leg until Usher gave him a smack with the butt end of her spear. Then he followed her quick enough. Shaggy Dog stalked after them. The last Bran saw of them was the dire wolf's tail as it vanished behind the broken tower. The iron portcullis that closed the Hunter's Gate had been warped so badly by heat it could not be raised more than a foot. They had to squeeze beneath its spikes, one by one. "Will we go to your Lord Father?" Bran asked, as they crossed the drawbridge between the walls. "To Greywater Watch?" Mira looked to her brother for the answer.
Our road is north, Jojen announced.
At the edge of the Wolf's Wood, Bran turned in his basket for one last glimpse of the castle that had been his life. Wisps of smoke still rose into the grey sky, but no more than might have risen from Winterfell's chimneys on a cold autumn afternoon. Soot stains marked some of the arrow loops, and here and there a crack or a missing merlon could be seen in the curtain wall. But it seemed little enough from this distance. Beyond, the tops of the keeps and towers still stood as they had for hundreds of years, and it was hard to tell that the castle had been sacked and burned at all. The stone is strong, Bran told himself. The roots of the trees go deep, and under the ground the kings of winter sit their thrones. So long as those remained, Winterfell remained. It was not dead, just broken. Like me, he thought. I'm not dead either.
John. Day and night the axes rang. John could not remember the last time he had slept. When he closed his eyes, he dreamed of fighting. When he woke, he fought. Even in the King's Tower, he could hear the ceaseless thunk of bronze and flint and stolen steel biting into wood, and it was louder when he tried to rest in the warming shed atop the wall. Mans had sledgehammers at work as well, and long saws with teeth of bone and flint. Once, as he was drifting off into an exhausted sleep, there came a great cracking from the haunted forest, and a sentinel tree came crashing down in a cloud of dirt and needles. He was awake when Owen came to him, lying restless under a pile of furs on the floor of the warming shed.
"Lord Snow," said Owen, shaking his shoulder, "the dawn."
He gave John a hand to help pull him back onto his feet. Others were waking as well, jostling one another as they pulled on their boots and buckled their sword belts in the close confines of the shed. No one spoke. They were all too tired to talk. Few of them ever left the wall these days. It took too long to ride up and down in the cage. Castle Black had been abandoned to Maester Aemon, Sir Winton Stout, and a few others too old or ill to fight.
"I had a dream that the king had come," Owen said happily. "Maester Aemon sent a raven, and King Robert came with all his strength. I dreamed I saw his golden banners."
John made himself smile.
That would be a welcome sight to see, Owen. Ignoring the twinge of pain in his leg, he swept a black fur cloak about his shoulders, gathered up his crutch, and went out onto the wall to face another day. A gust of wind sent icy tendrils wending through his long brown hair. Half a mile north, the wildling encampments were stirring, their campfires sending up smoky fingers to scratch against the pale dawn sky. Along the edge of the forest, they had raised their tents of hide and fur, even a crude long haul of logs and woven branches. There were horse lines to the east, mammoths to the west, and men everywhere, sharpening their swords, putting points on crude spears, donning makeshift armor of hide and horn and bone. For every man that he could see, John knew there were a score unseen in the wood. The brush gave them some shelter from the elements and hid them from the eyes of the hated crows. Already their archers were stealing forward, pushing their rolling mantlets. "Here come our breakfast arrows," Pip announced cheerfully, as he did every morning. "It's good he can make a jape of it," John thought. "Someone has to." 3 days ago, one of those breakfast arrows had caught Red Allen of the Rosewood in the leg. You could still see his body at the foot of the wall, if you cared to lean out far enough. John had to think that it was better for them to smile at Pip's jest than to brood over Allen's corpse. The mantlets were slanting wooden shields, wide enough for five of the free folk to hide behind. The archers pushed them close, then knelt behind them to loose their arrows through slits in the wood. The first time the wildlings rolled them out, John had called for fire arrows and set a half dozen ablaze, but after that men started covering them with raw hides. All the fire arrows in the world couldn't make them catch now. The brothers even started wagering as to which of the straw sentinels would collect the most arrows before they were done. Dolorous Ed was leading with four, but Othol Yarwick, Tumba John, and Wat of Longlake had three apiece. It was Pip who started naming the scarecrows after their missing brothers, too.
"It makes it seem as if there's more of us," he said. "More of us with arrows in our bellies," Gren complained,
but the custom did seem to give his brother's heart, so John let the name stand and the wagering continue. On the edge of the wall, an ornate brass Moorish eye stood on three spindly legs. Maester Aemon had once used it to peer at the stars, before his own eyes had failed him. John swung the tube down to have a look at the foe. Even at this distance, there was no mistaking Manse Raider's huge white tent, sewn together from the pelts of snow bears. The Moorish lenses brought the wildlings close enough for him to make out faces. Of Mance himself he saw no sign this morning, but his woman, Dala, was outside tending the fire, while her sister Val milked a she-goat beside the tent. Dala looked so big it was a wonder she could move. "A child must be coming very soon," John thought. He swiveled the eye east and searched amongst the tents and trees till he found the turtle. That will be coming very soon as well. The wildlings had skinned one of the dead mammoths during the night, and they were lashing the raw, bloody hide over the turtle's roof, one more layer on top of the sheepskins and pelts. The turtle had a rounded top and eight huge wheels, and under the hides was a stout wooden frame. When the wildlings had begun knocking it together, Saturn thought they were building a ship. Not far wrong. The turtle was a hull turned upside down and opened fore and aft, a long haul on wheels.
"It's done, isn't it?" asked Gren.
"Near enough." John shoved away the eye. "It will come today, most like. Did you fill the barrels?"
"Every one. They froze hard during the night. Pip checked."
Gren had changed a great deal from the big, clumsy, redneck boy John had first befriended. He had grown half a foot, his chest and shoulders had thickened, and he had not cut his hair nor trimmed his beard since the fist of the first men. It made him look as huge and shaggy as an oryx, the mocking name that Sir Alistair Thorne had hung on him during training. He looked weary now, though. When John said as much, he nodded.
"I heard their axes all night. Couldn't sleep for all the chopping,"
Then go sleep now.
I don't need. You do. I want you rested. Go on. I'm not going to let you sleep through the fight.
He made himself smile.
You're the only one who can move those bloody barrels.
Gren went off muttering, and John returned to the far eye, searching the wildling camp. From time to time an arrow would sail past overhead, but he learned to ignore those. The range was long, and the angle was bad. The chances of being hit were small. He still saw no sign of Mance Raider in the camp, but he spied Tormund Giantsbane and two of his sons around the turtle. The sons were struggling with the mammoth hide, while Tormund gnawed on the roast leg of a goat and bellowed orders. Elsewhere he found the wildling skin-changer, Varamyr Sixskins, walking through the trees with his shadow cat dogging his heels. When he heard the rattle of the winch chains and the iron groan of the cage door opening, he knew it would be Hub bringing their breakfast as he did every morning. The sight of Mance's turtle had robbed John of his appetite. Their oil was all but gone, and the last barrel of pitch had been rolled off the wall 2 nights ago. They would soon run short of arrows as well, and there were no Fletchers making more. And the night before last, a raven had come from the west, from Sir Dennis Mallister. Bowen Marsh had chased the wildlings all the way to the Shadow Tower, it seemed, and then farther, down into the gloom of the gorge. At the Bridge of Skulls he had met the Weeper and 300 wildlings and won a bloody battle. But the victory had been a costly one. More than 100 brothers slain, among them Sir Andrew Tarth and Sir Allardale Winch. The old pomegranate himself had been carried back to the Shadow Tower, sorely wounded. Maester Mullen was tending him, but it would be some time before he was fit to return to Castle Black. When he had read that, John had dispatched Zay to Molestown on their best horse to plead with the villagers to help man the wall. She never returned. When he sent Molly after her, he came back to report the whole village deserted, even the brothel. Most likely Zay had followed them, straight down the King's Road. Maybe we should all do the same, John reflected glumly. He made himself eat, hungry or no. Bad enough, he could not sleep. He could not go on without food as well. Besides, this might be my last meal. It might be the last meal for all of us. So it was that John had a belly full of bread, bacon, onions and cheese when he heard Horse shout, "It's coming!" No one needed to ask what it was. Nor did John need the maester's Moorish eye to see it creeping out from amongst the tents and trees. "It doesn't really look much like a turtle," Saturn commented. "Turtles don't have fur." "Most of them don't have wheels either," said Pip. "Sound the war horn," John commanded, and Keggs blew two long blasts to wake Gren and the other sleepers who'd had the watch during the night. If the wildlings were coming, the wall would need every man. Gods know we have few enough. John looked at Pip and Keggs and Satin, Horse and Owen the Oaf, Tim Tangletongue, Molly Spareboot and the rest, and tried to imagine them going belly to belly and blade to blade against 100 screaming wildlings in the freezing darkness of that tunnel, with only a few iron bars between them. That was what it would come down to, unless they could stop the turtle before the gate was breached.
"It's big," Horse said.
Pip smacked his lips. "Think of all the soup it will make." The jape was stillborn. Even Pip sounded tired. "He looks half dead," John thought. "But so do we all." The king beyond the wall had so many men that he could throw fresh attackers at them every time. But the same handful of black brothers had to meet every assault, and it had worn them ragged. The men beneath the wooden hides would be pulling hard, John knew, putting their shoulders into it, straining to keep the wheels turning. But once the turtle was flush against the gate, they would exchange their ropes for axes. At least Mance was not sending his mammoths today. John was glad of that. Their awesome strength was wasted on the wall, and their size only made them easy targets. The last had been a day and a half in the dying. Its mournful trumpeting was terrible to hear. The turtle crept slowly through stones and stumps and brush. The earlier attacks had cost the free folk 100 lives or more. Most still lay where they had fallen.